Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 100, section 4, which is old single column, page 1097. So, last week, we completed this introduction, as they do at the beginning of this paper, to some of the basic facts about growth, what the revelators mean by that term. Remember, we talked a lot about it. You know, you can, when you start to think about it more analytically, it's perfecting spirit and how that extends down through mind and living matter all the way to varying things, change. And got some of these classics of change without growth, and man cannot cause growth. So having given us those, all those, laid out those basics for us. That is, if the reader can unpack them, the basics are laid out, and that's what we did. We unpacked it so that we have the basics. Definitely, if you remind yourself that growth is perfecting spirit, we constantly are seeing in the Arantia book that when you get to genuine spirit, as opposed to what humans have always used that word for, no matter how they've used it, spirit is when you actually bring spirit into play in your mind, because you have free will control over how spirit engages your mind. It's a double-edged sword. When genuine spiritual issues are in play, it's always a double-edged sword. It's not all sunshine and lollipops. There's always problems. And hence this next section. They want to talk about some of the basic ways that you've got problematic issues, kind of even at a rudimentary level. Not to mention, if you carry things to any lengths, you can have serious, serious cataclysmic problems. Not so much for each of us individually now, because of what Michael did when he completed the fourth epical revelation, where we all have adjusters by grace, and hence souls by grace. You don't have any more of an issue, basically, than you ever did about, the problems of an individual going to iniquity. I mean, sure, that's always in play, but that's a tall order. But these potentially cataclysmic consequences of the misuse of spirit definitely can, because any sort of a spiritual nature has automatic fruits, right? Whether that spiritual nature is helpful or not, it has automatic fruits that flow out into society. And if you are ill-posed inside, it's going to have sweeping, cataclysmic even consequences. That's why the book is here, right? That has begun to happen more and more unwittingly because of the evolution of mind, where we're more spiritual than mankind has ever been, just naturally. And you have universal bestowals of thought adjusters and everything that can be abused. That emergency situation we'll see comes out between the lines, but maybe not so much between the lines as we get to the latter part of this section. Problems both small and quite large are in play. Okay, so let's see what they've got here.
Section 4, Problems of Growth. Religious living is devoted living, and devoted living is creative living, original and spontaneous. New religious insights arise out of conflicts which initiate the choosing of new and better reaction habits in the place of older and inferior reaction patterns. New meanings only emerge amid conflict, and conflict persists only in the face of refusal to espouse the higher values connoted in superior meanings.
Okay. As you can probably already tell, even with that opening paragraph, they're continuing forward just like they did in Section 3. Once they laid out some of the physics in Section 2, they're expecting you to be thinking in sophisticated, precise ways about this. So they're not just going to talk in fuzzy generalities. Even at the end, espouse the higher meanings connoted by superior, or espouse the higher values connoted by superior meanings. The relationship between values and meanings. Right? Just always have that immediately, so that you can appreciate what they're saying. The superadditive consequence of the relationship between things and values is meanings. So that meanings can connote values. If you got a hold of the meanings, you know it didn't come from nowhere. Right? It had to have come from a relationship between things and values. Without values, there can't be meanings. Some of the other issues there. Okay, look how they start. We brought this up some recently, and here you see it kind of stated directly. So when they go through that little sequence, religious living is devoted living, and devoted living is creative living, original and spontaneous. First of all, just, remind yourself when they gave us our first three favorable conditions that we're always talking about in Section 1, loyal, humble, sincere. Remember that it was very important that they challenged the sense of the word sincere to get out of that natural, for all the last million years, sense about sincerity that's tied to its literalness of purity. So don't just think purity, especially, a material idealism sort of purity. But think of, kind of burn that definition in your mind. Wholehearted devotion to supreme values. And it's at the end of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the sixth paragraph there in Section 1. That one is a lot like personal realization of divine fellowship, as a definition for love, instead of whatever. Right? Wholehearted devotion to supreme value. So you've got that burned in your mind, and then you start reading, religious living is devoted living. Right? Wholehearted devotion to supreme values. There's sincerity. Religious living is sincere living. And since, that wholehearted, when you think of the whole thing, wholehearted devotion to supreme values, okay, you're fully up with your personality, and its creativity. It's creative living. And that difference between creative and merely inventive or clever, right? Creative is originative, like they're saying there. See, original and spontaneous. And remember the literalness of the word spontaneous, of free will. Right? It's originative and it's of free will. Okay, it's not just the cleverness of a fancy animal that just that's what's out there, brings it in, reprocesses it in some clever way and spits it back out again, right, into the world. And everyone goes, ooh, 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 what fancy ejecta you have there. Right. We're definitely talking about genuine religion here. And then you're probably already suspecting, if you've got another of the classics at the forefront of your mind, effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress. Right, those, you know, eight steps, you know, along the path to progress. You know, so if you see the word conflict, you go, I wonder. And you definitely see it here. New religious insights arise out of conflicts. Right? If you're going to make progress, you know, to new religious insights, right? I mean, you can only get there through conflict. And look at the way they refer to that, which initiate the choosing of new and better reaction habits in the place of older and inferior reaction patterns. You know, why isn't it merely older and inferior reaction habits? Because we're not merely fancy animals with habits. We have a personality that unwittingly is behind the scenes. You know, and the longer a habit is there, the more you unwittingly start to identify personality, spirit pattern, right, with it. The inferior reaction patterns. It's difficult enough to redirect a habit, but if you've kind of existentialized it with pattern, much more difficult.
Problems of growth.
Yeah. So, see, just in this very first thing, okay, it doesn't sound like it's a global cataclysm yet, okay, but, right, there, just because, no matter how much you're clueless of your real personal spiritual nature, and you're kind of just conscious of your fancy animalness, you know, and you may call it personal, but whatever, I mean, the personality is there, and it's going to constantly be doing problematic things when you're not consciously tending to it. It's going to want to existentialize everything that is not, you know, about eternity. You know, and it's going to want to existentialize, you know, not only all the temporal, but, you know, yourself. All of its temperaments, right, and, you know, inclinations and whatnot, tendencies. You know, and get them just set in stone. So it's a problem, you know, just to be growable, right, if you've locked down like that, even if you aren't aware that you've locked down. That predicate of getting to the favorable conditions, you know, specifically thinking about loyal or humble or whatever, but first you've got to get yourself in a reflective state of mind, which innately is a state where you let go. See, you're willing to be reflecting is to be willing to redirect, to change, to think of things anew, right? New religious insights. Well, I mean, if you're not open to new except through a reflective state, where you've, you know, and to put yourself in that open to the cosmos reflective state. See, I my hands have been clamped on myself. I have to, you know, let go of them and open my hands up. You know, I open my mind up to a bigger picture. Yeah. So
sounds like self-forgetting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Some degree, you got to be willing to forget about the self, right, and consider something else. All right, so, you know, and then again about the conflict. You know, new meanings only emerge amid conflict. So in the opening paragraph, they've used conflict twice. highly suspicious.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and if you have an aversion to any sort of difficulty, you know, that could be called a conflict, you know, it doesn't have to be an overt material external world conflict with swords or something, right? Any sort of internal mental conflict. If you have an aversion to that, okay, forget about it. Nothing's going to happen.
Nothing to see here.
You know, and if you take your initial animal tendency to shy away from conflict, you know, and unwittingly clamp down with your personality on that. Okay, so that's what they're giving you, that opening, just the basics, before you consider any of the greater complexities, just the basic aspect of what you're up against. If you haven't, you know, if you're part of the sad to record crowd, you haven't really reflected much in your life, you're not aware of how many things you're clamped down on, and you're unwittingly absolutely certain about a whole bunch of things that you should not be absolutely certain about. All right, let's see where they go next.
Religious perplexities are inevitable. There can be no growth without psychic conflict and spiritual agitation. The organization of a philosophic standard of living entails considerable commotion in the philosophic realms of the mind. Loyalties are not exercised in behalf of the great, the good, the true, and the noble without a struggle. Effort is attendant upon clarification of spiritual vision and enhancement of cosmic insight. And the human intellect protests against being weaned from subsisting upon the non-spiritual energies of temporal existence. The slothful animal mind rebels at the effort required to wrestle with cosmic problem solving.
Okay. Before we look at anything else, since it's been queued up, you go, it's not just the word conflict, which they repeated, right? Didn't they? Yeah. Sure enough, they repeated conflict. They're in the opening sentence, but then they followed it with next down struggle and down the bottom effort, right? We've got effort, struggle, conflict. Right. So it's now trivially obvious that that's one of the main things they want you to have in mind as you're reading this. You know, that you've got that sequence that begins effort, struggle, conflict, and for the timid soul, stalls out there. Okay. As they're saying there, and the human intellect protests against being weaned from subsisting upon the non-spiritual energies of temporal existence. I mean, and like I said, I mean it's difficult to get an animal to change its habits. But if you've existentialized them basically with your personality, you know, patterned them, purposed them. The human intellect is going to protest, right? You can't make me, you can't make me. And your rationalization engine will spin up and come up with all sorts of reasons why, you know, this is wrong, you know, you will say to yourself, right?
By multiplying your tribulation.
Yeah, not to mention, you know, the indolence of the slothful animal, you know, the pain avoidance, you know, doesn't want to wrestle with cosmic problem solving. They'd like to just to find a, you know, a palapa and a cold drink, you know, right?
I love the considerable commotion. All the languages, it's just great.
Yeah.
Great yeah. Spiritual agitation.
Yeah, so then, you know, let's look at all those. Just why are religious perplexities inevitable? Because part of the thing there is you've got to be thinking genuine religion, or that sentence is not valid. Okay, so you know, with genuine religion, religious perplexities are inevitable. Why are they inevitable? Because genuine religious character is unnatural, right? You know, basic evolutionary religion, right, that's the that in that sense, religious perplexities aren't inevitable because it's all about being natural. Yeah. Right? Taking the fancy parts of the natural and exalting them into, you know, spiritual woo-woo, right? But genuine religion is innately unnatural. So it's inescapable, right? It's inevitable. Like, you know, there's going to be perplexities. You're up against, you know, everything that is, you know, innately natural. So, you know, there can be no growth without psychic conflict and spiritual agitation. Okay, and the moment that they're saying psychic, you know, you want to think, it's like, well, should I take this a little bit more literally? Remember, psyche means soul. Right? So are they, you know, are they wanting me to not just kind of think, well, humans use like psychiatry or whatever, right, or psychology. Do they want me to think a little more literally? You know, and I'll tell you up front, they do, right? So psychic conflict, you know, that upper domain, you know, that it is often, we often call our soul, right, because that's what gets copied to make the literal, Marantia, soul, right? There's going to be conflict up there. You know, this is, you know, how you are entering that domain in this mode we're thinking about. I've gone effort, struggle, conflict, and I'm at the doorway of the upper domain. And see, that's what I'm, you know, why I'm wanting to enter that domain, to do something about this conflict. And what's up there right now, which I, you know, I've drug in from the outside and put up there, you know, is not up to the task. I've got to remake that whole upper domain to deal with the conflict. The conflict is kind of really between a new experience and that you've brought up there through effort, struggle into conflict, and the pre-established habits, right? See, that you've patternized up there. Right? You know, maybe it isn't even so much your habits, but just the mori system, you know, that you've identified with, and hence it's your habits, right? You know, that gets drug up and put up there. And you know, it's not up to the task. There is a serious conflict. You're going to have to, you know, blow up everything up there and start from scratch to deal with this. So like they're saying, you know, this is going to entail considerable commotion in the philosophic realms of the mind. The upper domain is the philosophic realm. And let's remember again, you know, this, when they say philosophic standard of living, you know, you've got, you have a particular way you live, which we call a philosophy of living. That way of living isn't in and of itself philosophy. You know, the upper domain, you establish a personal living philosophy up there. That's the philosophic domain, right? And then that's your predicate. You bring that down and out, you know, in relationship to your day-to-day life in a certain modality called your philosophy of living. See, that way of living is predicated on that personal living philosophy in the upper domain. You need to modify your way of living, but there's a given way of living for a given upper domain. So you've got to change the upper domain. If you're going to change, you know, that way of living, have a different philosophy of living. That's what they're getting at. And, you know, and you notice they even mentioned one of the favorable conditions. Loyalties are not exercised, you know, et cetera. That first one, loyal. So, you know, when we see a man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions, and you're going, okay, I'm just going to squint really hard, and then I'm going to be loyal, and I've got a favorable condition. It's like, no, as they're saying, that's not exercised in behalf of anything without a struggle, and effort is attendant upon. You've got to go through this process. If you're going to progress into an improved state of loyalty, you've got to go effort, struggle, conflict, etc. So this is, you know, it's a rigorous process to genuinely be more loyal, and hence have those more favorable conditions. To genuinely be more humble, and have those favorable conditions. I'm gonna be more humble. And then you come upon some. It's like, oh man, there's a conflict there. I think now is not the time to be humble. See, you find these conflicts that you got to deal with. Okay, so, you know, but it's obvious that if you're going to do cosmic problem solving, like they say at the end there, you know, that's what a personal living philosophy is about. It's bringing the cosmos, you know, into your mind. That holistic cosmos is a personal living philosophy, you know, when you grab a hold of it with your personality and realize it within you. All right, let's keep going.
But the great problem of religious living consists in the task of unifying the soul powers of the personality by the dominance of love. Health, mental efficiency, and happiness arise from the unification of physical systems, mind systems, and spirit systems. Of health and sanity, man understands much, but of happiness, he has truly realized very little. The highest happiness is indissolubly linked with spiritual progress. Spiritual growth yields lasting joy, peace which passes all understanding.
Every one of these paragraphs, because there's so much kind of physics, you know, in their use of language, you have to really stop and parse out. So, so it says the great problem of religious living consists in the task of unifying the soul powers of the personality by the dominance of love in all caps. Okay, what's up there? Well, you know, in a simplest sense, when you've got something in all caps, you in the book, you're thinking, okay, it's in a definition sort of a mode. Well, they don't seem to be defining the word love here, but the fact that they do it in all caps, they want to remind you specifically, love, you know, that word as herein defined. Not as the dictionary says, not as your favorite writer says, right, but herein defined. And when you say herein defined, what's innate in that is, you know, we're talking very top-down objective definition. Definitely starting with eternity, not with time. Right? Definitely much more, you know, related to the existential than the experiential. Okay. So by doing all caps like that, it's just a simple way of saying, okay, if you're going to understand what we're going to say here, you can't start with, you know, your favorite poster at the dentist office, right, about love. Love is a warm puppy or something, right? Right, so that's a point there. So personal realization of divine fellowship. Right, it's got that word divine in it. Tall order, right? Yeah, you aren't divine, right? In fact, until you are a resident of the Isle of Paradise. You are in eternity. Right? You've grown to the point where you can synchronize with the raw existential. Okay? No buffer, right, basically. All right, so, yeah. A high fact. And you've got to get that dominance. That's got to be at the top of everything. And then look how they go into the threefold actuality. You know, we even mentioned that, you know, in the next to the last paragraph, you know, of the preceding section when they said physical, intellectual, or spiritual. Right? And we talked about that triune picture. And I said, you know, a less abstract way to think about it is to think health, sanity, happiness. Right? And, you know, and notice here they they didn't just repeat what they say up there in paper two, health, sanity, happiness. They tweaked it a little bit. Health, mental efficiency, and happiness. And then subsequently, you know, they said of health and sanity. Yeah. Just to give you, not miss an opportunity to get you to think a little bit more about the physics of sanity. Okay. By saying mental efficiency. So, you know, again, that triunity, right, is going to be encompassed by a very definitive personal sphere, personal realization of divine fellowship. Right? That personal fact can encompass the three of health, sanity, and happiness. Physical systems, mind systems, spirit systems, again, right? I remind you that it definitely is the triunity that we're talking about here. And then, you know, one of the most challenging statements in the book to your contentment about where you are. I don't need to be growing. I'm all over it. Of health and sanity, man understands much. Of course, that wasn't true, you know, too much before the beginning of the 20th century, right? But of health and sanity, man understands much. But of happiness, he has truly realized very little. Right? That choice that is happiness, we have truly realized very little. So, in other words, anything that's right there with that, you know, definitively personal, spiritual choice of happiness, we also know very little. Religion, faith, worship, love. You can't say that about happiness and think, oh, yeah, but the others, you know, we're all over. No, no. They're all together. Right? You know, because you can't look up the proper definition of the word faith in the dictionary, right, that's why we have truly realized very little of happiness. Right? They go hand in hand. You know, why the word happiness is so corrupted now. You know, just like I mentioned the word love is, right? Or it's just these, you know, fuzzy platitudes, you know, that you get emailed, right? you get spammed. it's like, no, genuine love is not some warm, fuzzy spam email, right? It's a very rigorous, robust fact. And it's quite uncommon that anyone has a genuine predicate of L-O-V-E, all caps, like they were saying, right? Okay, and the highest happiness is indissolubly linked with spiritual progress. Right? I mean, you've got an initial happiness potential with your initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit and the personality identification thereto. Okay, but that's, you know, doesn't get you anywhere near highest happiness, right? An unnaturalness in the face of something very, very challenging. You're going to have to be growing. And in sort of the analysis of that growth, like we talked about, there's going to have to be progress. Yeah, and we were just reminded, effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and then and only then progress. Right? So it's a dance between being grown and a fullness of you achieving the favorable conditions. Right? Your bottom-up effort meets a top-down engagement, and then it all comes together. When they say, notice how they bring in joy, and that contrast between happiness and joy. Yeah, happiness is a choice. Joy is a spiritual experience. It's like, well, it almost makes it sound like they're synonyms here. It's like, well, yeah, but you know they're not. So think about what they're saying. When they say spiritual growth yields lasting joy, if you actually are grown, you now are aware of a positive spiritual environment that you were previously oblivious to. I mean, there has to be a positive spiritual environment in order for you to have the reaction called joy. Right? You just, that's, you know, when you respond to a positive, you know, recognition of a positive spiritual environment, you feel a feeling called joy. Right? If you can't see it, you won't feel it. And to begin with, we have limited, you know, insight of the spiritual. But if you're progressed upward, right, you go, well, I couldn't see it before, but now I can see it. I mean, to the point finally where no matter what's going on, you know that now is a divine dispensation. It's not just a good one; it's actually a divine one. Right? It's that spiritual, but unrecognized. You know, if you get to the point where you actually see the potentiality, in a sense, see, not the benighted actuality, right? You don't need to unnaturally have a positive response to a negative stimulus. You actually have a positive stimulus that you can just be joyful therein. And there's still plenty of things where you're going to need to have a positive response to an apparent negative stimulus, okay? But to actually be grown where you can just have some joy, right? And you don't have to, it's like, okay, my natural reaction here is not positive, okay, but I'm going to hold myself together. I mean, what a delight to just let the joy happen, right?
When's the last time you feasted on uncertainty, disappointment, enthused in the face of parenting?
Yeah, yeah. So that's what they're getting at. See, and you know, once that, you know, the real spiritual nature is more evident to you, right, there's a peace that passes all understanding. Right? See, you see what people don't see, right? and that gives you peace that they can't have. They think you're you know hallucinating or something, right? And they think you're crazy. They think you're beside yourself when you have peace that passes all understanding. Okay. But you know that which they do not. And like we saw in the first paragraph, to a degree will not. Right? Yeah. They've sort of willed their lack of sight unwittingly, right? All right, so health, sanity, happiness, you know, that full encompassment. You want to get that, you know, that dominance of love and have this very existential, see, encompassing predicate to all of the experiential complexities. Again, hence the capitalizing the L-O-V-E, see, just to remind you of that. You know, you can't wrap, you know, some feeling you call love around that, and you know, and have it, you know. I mean, you know, the difficulties are going to break through that, you know, that white veneer quickly. You're going to need genuine love.
Do they capitalize that anywhere else? Is that in one place where
they? I can't remember if they. Yeah, I don't. They do the all caps thing, you know, occasionally, just for this reason. Okay. You know. And of course, up in the foreword, you know, you often see it, and it's kind of a very immediately definition sort of a modality, right? Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, they throw in one like that, you know, just to remind you. All right.
In physical life, the senses tell of the existence of things. Mind discovers the reality of meanings. But the spiritual experience reveals to the individual the true values of life. These high levels of human living are attained in the supreme love of God and in the unselfish love of man. If you love your fellow men, you must have discovered their values. Jesus loved men so much because he placed such a high value upon them. You can best discover values in your associates by discovering their motivation. If someone irritates you, causes feelings of resentment, you should sympathetically seek to discern his viewpoint, his reasons for such objectionable conduct. If once you understand your neighbor, you will become tolerant, and this tolerance will grow into friendship and ripen into love.
All right. So, you know, here they start throwing out the word love, right, in a very applied mode. If you're just in the old wineskin about the word love, okay, this paragraph is going to have unfortunate consequences, you know, in your life. You know, a delusional belief about the power of feelings. Yeah. but again, just, you know, how does the paragraph start out? Things, meanings, values. I mean, we're in this very definitive fifth epical revelation physics, right, of the threefold actuality. Yeah, reminding you that, you know, like when they say the supreme love of God, again, personal realization of divine fellowship. Okay, you've got to take it all the way up. So when you say if when they start talking kind of that normal parlance, if you love your fellow men, okay, you can't think of that verb that of love there like you've always thought about it, right? And I feel for my fellow man, I care for my fellow man, or whatever, right? I mean, it's got to go way beyond that. I mean, what it's saying is if you recognize their personal realization of divine fellowship, which you can because you recognize your personal realization of divine fellowship, and if you recognize your personality, you can recognize someone else's personality, and then see the immediate things that go with that personality, like a personal realization of divine fellowship, right? See, that's what they're really saying. When you love your fellow man, if you look at them foundationally that way, no matter what is coming out of their mouth or what objectionable thing they're doing with their body, right? Underlying all that, transcendent of all that, is that personal realization of divine fellowship that was put there by grace and made them a child of God. Right? That's what they mean by if you love your fellow man. If you see them fundamentally that way. Right? If you see them fundamentally that way, if that's what love means to you, you can love your enemies like Jesus told you to do. Right? Because they're enemies because of you know, what they talk about later on there, you know, objectionable conduct. Right? They're not your enemies because they're not properly encircuited by the mother and personalized by the father. Right? They just aren't availing themselves of that predicate and, you know, and are very objectionable. But you know, if you can start with what they are by grace, which is not manifesting, okay, I'll grant you that, it's not manifesting, but if you can start what's there hidden by grace, there by grace and is hidden, then you can challenge yourself to, it's like, well, let me put myself in their position, which I can do because not only can I put myself at their objective foundation point, like I start with myself, and I know myself from there, so I kind of know the way myself, you know, reacts naturally to things and stuff. I can put myself in the place of that person, and I can understand why they react that way. I mean, it doesn't matter how much I would never react that way, but I understand. Well, I mean, there's no way I can understand, you know, why they react that way if I don't understand why I react the way I do, right? If I don't know myself first, then this is all impossible, right? So first you got to figure out that you just have some natural temperaments, right? That produce certain, you know, natural reactions to stimuli, right? It's not, It's not your divine character or something. It's just the way you started, okay? You know, and behaving in that natural way isn't the right way, and any other reaction is the wrong way, right? It's just your way, you know, that you have naturally. You know, the universe could care less, okay? Now, you know, if you've gotten humble about yourself like that, okay, then you can put yourself in the position of someone else. You can understand. Okay, no matter how objectionable, okay, I understand why they react. They have certain, you know, initial assumptions that just lead to that inexorably. Okay, I get that. You know, if I understand them that way, okay, I can actually be tolerant. It's impossible to be tolerant if I'm right and you're wrong. Right? If you have that very unfortunate sense, you know, ghost cult definition of right and wrong, you know, right is correct conduct, okay? And of course, you know, the moray that you identify with defines what, you know, correct conduct is. And boy, that's not conforming to the moray, so that's wrong. No, right and wrong don't have anything to do with such things. Right? Nothing at all. Yeah, but that's all humans have ever known about the words right and wrong. Right? The Answer Book is talking about something totally different that humans haven't thought about. that the words right and wrong genuinely refer to. You know, this bit of you know, if you can, you know, it starts with you. Finding your existential observation point, figuring out the naturalness of yourself, know thyself, you know, and then beginning to use that. Go over to someone else's existential, you know, vantage point and look down and sort out their self and its natural inclinations. And it's like, okay, now I can approach this person objectively, you know, instead of just seeing them as objectionable.
I really like it when people that I'm interacting with treat me like I'm of value. Mm-hmm. And when I do something that, you know, they flinch at, you know, it irritates them, I really appreciate it when they make an effort to try to figure out why it is that I would do something.
Yeah.
And, you know, often they'll go, oh, okay. Yeah, I see. And then they might say, oh, I was thinking about it like this. And then you go, oh, yeah, I can see that too. And then suddenly you're just kind of, yeah. You know, it works.
Yeah.
It's cool. It feels so good.
Notice how you've gotten above the conflict. Yeah. See the upper domain, well, it can allow, you know, allow two people to get above these, you know, inescapable conflicts, you know, of temperament.
But like you said,
reaction.
Just, you know, you know, you looking at them as another child of God and putting in that effort because you value them.
Right.
That's the key, like
yeah.
You said.
Yeah, starting, you know, saying it that way, what we were just saying. Start with, it's a given that they have value, by grace if nothing else, okay? So now let's work down from there, right, to these tensions. Right? But there's no tension between the value, relationship to value that we were all given by grace. We're all on this exact same page, right, by grace. If we start there, okay, then we can work down, deal with the tensions that are inescapable and the differences of mind. Before we go on, when you go beyond the, you know, kind of individual or, you know, relationships between two individuals, in the bigger sense of society, you know, if you can't get above these natural differences of reaction to stimuli. It's impossible to get to a nation, right? You know, because you're going unnatural when you go above tribe to nation, right? That a tribe is a natural grouping of people that have, you know, basically the same likes and dislikes, right? If you refuse to accept that which you dislike, right? If you can't be tolerant, there can't be a nation. You know, and we know that, you know, the United States is collapsing as a nation. It's going back down to, you know, material gravity is dragging it back down to tribalism. Because no one is making this unnatural effort. You know, and it's very poignant. I mean, it's difficult enough to deal with someone you naturally dislike in just some simple, you know, interaction at work or something, right? But what if a person is elected president that you dislike naturally? You think we can have a nation if you're, you know, if, you know, because you dislike that, it's wrong, you know, by definition, you know, you have a right to hate them, etc. You know, you certainly have a right to be intolerant, right? Like, no, you can't have a nation. To be a nation is to be willing to let someone that you naturally dislike lead you. You know, not just be the president, but lead you. Right? And if you will not be led by that which you dislike, you can't have a nation. That's the difficulty of a nation. Right? No wonder Red Man couldn't really get there. He just constantly was, I really, really dislike that. And I think, I mean, I so dislike it, I don't want to just, like, not, I want to be a tribe apart from it. I want to get our tribe to kill that tribe of people who think that way. Right? I mean, that was Red Man's great problem. He could never get to a nation because he could not stop existentializing his likes and dislikes. Right? So, this is why civilization's in jeopardy. Right? You know, lots of lip service to tolerance, but no real tolerance. Right? You don't have to be tolerant of that which you like. Yeah. Right? And if you refuse to relate to anyone except that which you like, I'm so tolerant of that which I like. No, you aren't. There's no tolerance there.
You found your tribe.
Right. Right. So, and notice too that, you know, feelings have a place here. Kind of back to the paragraph. You know, you should sympathetically seek to discern his viewpoint. You know, that kind of fullness of feeling there with sympathy down in the lower domain. Okay, I mean, you're not going to try to somehow ignore your feelings. It's like, well, I don't have any natural feelings of sympathy. Yeah, exactly. Right? Sympathy, you know, is something you start with compassion up in the upper domain. Right? This is predicated on this common recognition of love, right? Personal realization of divine fellowship. You start with the compassion up there, and then you bring that down as a sympathy. Right? A feeling that's not predicated on what's out there, but a feeling that's predicated on what's up within you.
What's up?
Right? Sympathy. You sympathetically. Right?
Some fun etymology, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, compassion and sympathy are basically the same words etymologically, you know, one in Latin and the other in Greek, okay? But the way they're used and differentiated is the compassion is in the upper domain and the sympathy, the together feeling, right? The sympathy, the together feeling is in the lower domain.
Like the shadow and the substance,
yeah,
relationship.
Right. See, to have this genuine sympathy that's a top-down phenomenon, okay? And you can take, you know, bring that, you know, use that feeling of withness, right? The sim, you know, the sim part of sympathy, right, is together, right, with. All right. So you start with understanding him, then you can become tolerant, and this tolerance will grow into friendship and ripen into love. Okay, now we always talk about how the word friend is innately the word love. It's like, well, what's the difference between grow into friendship and ripen into love? Remember, they capitalized the word love, and we were reminded it's how existential that is. I mean, friendship is experiential. See, so, you know, to think about that precisely. See, you know, it will be grown, you know, into friendship, this experiential phenomenon. And that ripens into a greater relationship with the existential above that experiential. See, if you don't have that all sorted out, and you know that friend means love, basically, you know, or loving, yeah, you can't make hide your hair out of that. It's like, what does that mean? It's like, I thought those were on the same level. You know, how is it seeming, how are they seeming to stack them vertically there? The existential is always going to be transcendent to the experiential, no matter how lofty the experiential. Okay, look at this. See, it's very, look at how precise this is. All of this sort of physics-like wording. All right, well, then we got the paragraph that everyone remembers.
In the mind's eye, conjure up a picture of one of your primitive ancestors of cave-dwelling times. A short, misshapen, filthy, snarling hulk of a man, standing, legs spread, club upraised, breathing hate and animosity as he looks fiercely just ahead. Such a picture hardly depicts the divine dignity of man. But allow us to enlarge the picture. In front of this animated human crouches a saber-toothed tiger. Behind him, a woman and two children. Immediately you recognize that such a picture stands for the beginnings of much that is fine and noble in the human race. But the man is the same in both pictures. Only in the second sketch you are favored with a widened horizon. You therein discern the motivation of this evolving mortal. His attitude becomes praiseworthy because you understand him. If you could only fathom the motives of your associates, how much better you would understand them. If you could only know your fellows, you would eventually fall in love with them.
You could get to that love your enemies thing that Jesus told you to get to. All right, so everyone knows this paragraph, but do you live this paragraph? Right? Or do you, as soon as you see, you know, the snarling, apparently snarling, you know, Hulk, do you stop right there? Oh, don't need to know anything else about that person. Matter of fact, they're so mean, I'm justified to be intolerant and hateful relative to them. Period, end of story. Okay. Lots of people delight in this paragraph and say they, you know, it's one of their favorite things in the book, and, you know, hence they, you know, it has great meaning to them, great consequence to them. Okay, but their behavior says otherwise, right? Because their life is filled with people they hate. Right? They haven't made one iota of effort to go beyond the snarling that's right in front of them. And do anything that the preceding paragraph told him to do, right? Which this is just illustrating, right? This paragraph is just an illustration of the preceding paragraph. Right? Have you actually, and notice they added one other little thing to this bit about understanding someone else. You need to expand your picture. You can't just stare at the apparently just innately mean person. Right? You need to expand the picture and see why they are being aggressive like that. You know, and it's metaphorically, it's extremely common that this is the illustration is there. If you just expand, almost always, if you go beyond the meanness of the person, you see in front of them is something that's threatening, and behind them is something they're trying to protect. Almost always. And if you never expand out, if you just judge them, you know, with these blinders on, so all you can see is their snarling face, I mean, what am I going to do? Right? What's God going to do with you? You know, you're never going to be grown. You can't be grown. You're fixating like this. You have to let go and expand out. You know, and I'll guarantee you 99.9% of the time, if you just expand out, you can see, right, what's in front and what's behind. Something aggressive in front, something that needs to be protected, shielded behind. It's as simple as that. And, you know, and that person that you so desperately think you have a right to hate, right, you need to see that their attitude is praiseworthy, and you should praise them for it. Right? And if you can't get to the point where you'll praise them for the practicality of their actions, and this guy's being very practical, right? Saber-tooth tiger, okay, wife and kids, okay? It's a very practical situation. If you can't praise the practicalness, you're never going to love them. I mean, you can't even deal with the material issue objectively. How are you ever going to get to the spiritual fact of love? Forget about it. You're delusional if you think you have any relationship to love. If you can't even see things in a pragmatic simplicity, right? By widening your view. Right. So it's sad to record, right? Mm-hmm. How much lip service or, you know, feelingful identification there is with a passage like this in the book, and yet, right, by your fruits are you known.
I can easily imagine the Mansion Worlds being a program of working these areas of deficiency, like.
Right.
Massive.
Yeah, the first two Mansion Worlds, you know, especially the first one, it's all about this. Right? People live and die giving lip service to love and whatnot. You know, it's square one, right, on the first Mansion World. Because, you know, they haven't even remotely attempted. You know, and that's why there's an emergency. Even fewer people are making any effort now, to the point of an emergency, to bridge simple divides of difference of temperament, yeah, right? Or thinking about why someone is being aggressive, it may be very appropriate. Sometimes there are difficult issues that have to be faced, and people that need to be helped that can't help themselves. You know, the woman can't attack the saber-toothed tiger. She's got to protect the kids, right? And keep them from, you know, going completely panicky. And, right? I mean, she's got to try to help them. Right? So someone else has got to pick up a club. Right? And thank God there is someone, right, that can pick up a club. When there's something that needs to be clubbed, right? It's not behaving in a proper social way. Okay, antisocial things have to be aggressively dealt with. You can't just pretend they aren't there.
Question from John.
Yep.
Is this about forgiveness, like Jesus saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do"?
If you can get to the point where you understand why someone is doing what they're doing, as they just pointed out, see, it won't be objectionable anymore. You won't take offense in the first place. So there is no such thing as forgiveness. Right? See, once you don't take offense, you've transcended human notions of forgiveness. Right? Genuine, objective forgiveness is not what you think forgiveness is at all. It's just patient love. Foundation of love, and you're patient about the fact that we don't we aren't all finaliters right now. And there's these all these tensions, you know, that are just inescapably there. I mean, Jesus is saying things like, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Not because he thinks, well, you know, he's got to talk to the vengeful volcano god and try to calm him down so he doesn't smite these Romans or whatever, right? So, no, he's saying that for the benefit of those who can hear, right? In the same way that he would pray just for the benefit of those that are observing him, not because he needed to pray. Right?
For a God of love, all is already forgiven.
Yeah, you can't offend the universal Father. There is no such thing as forgiveness, right? In the ghost cult sense that humans use that word. There is, right. Forgiveness is a temporal word. The existential Father has no relationship to time. Right? There's no meaning of that word in the normal sense, you know, relative to the universal Father. He can't get offended. He can't forgive. I mean, he's transcendent of those temporal things. It has nothing to do with the Father.
Irrelevant.
Yeah, this is completely irrelevant, yeah. But humans, you know, can't start out that objectively. But like I said, I mean, you know, I mean, we've done the old modality of forgiveness and redemption and sin sacrifice and atonement and what have you for a million years. Let's try something new. Instead of trying to upgrade your sense of forgiveness or how much you challenge yourself to forgive, why don't you just get above such issues? Why don't you just not be offended? Right? Like they're telling you in this paragraph right here, that, you know, before the illustration of the saber-toothed tiger. Right? I mean, naturally, you're offended. Well, how about being religious first and having an unnatural response to a stimulus? Don't be offended. Just take control of yourself.
I don't think Jesus ever forgave anyone. He loved them.
Yeah.
Right.
Jesus doesn't have to forgive anyone. He was never offended.
He placed a high value on them.
He loved them, right? He, and again, like I said, he it's not that he had positive feelings for everyone. Did he have positive feelings for Herod Antipas? No. He was wicked. Okay? But even though Herod was wicked, doesn't mean that Jesus knew, felt he had the right to hate Herod. Right? He loved Herod. In all of his wickedness, he still loved him. Because he wasn't iniquitous. There was still a child of God there. He could still identify with that unused love foundation. Deep down inside of Herod. But in practical terms, he's got to deal with the fact that he's got a spewing blob of wickedness. Okay, and you got to deal with that. Right? You don't say anything, you know, when he talks to you or whatever. Right? You got to deal with it, you know, pragmatically. But he never hated him.
It's like when he was severe with the apostles. There wasn't any hatred in that.
No. They needed to be severe because they'd gotten to the point where they were playing with the double-edged sword, like we're reading about here, and they didn't know it was a double-edged sword, right? And that this side of the blade cuts into their forehead. Yeah. All right. So, again, you know, don't let, you know, this delightful illustration just become this inconsequential platitude. Right? Change the way you relate to others based upon what it says in these two paragraphs. Okay, and then you notice how we're building up in kind of a, I was talking not to timid souls there, I was being pretty aggressive. Yeah, well, it's even more so in the final paragraph.
You cannot truly love your fellows by a mere act of the will. Love is only born of thoroughgoing understanding of your neighbor's motives and sentiments. It is not so important to love all men today as it is that each day you learn to love one more human being. If each day or each week you achieve an understanding of one more of your fellows, and if this is the limit of your ability, then you are certainly socializing and truly spiritualizing your personality. Love is infectious, and when human devotion is intelligent and wise, love is more catching than hate. But only genuine and unselfish love is truly contagious. If each mortal could only become a focus of dynamic affection, this benign virus of love would soon pervade the sentimental emotion stream of humanity to such an extent that all civilization would be encompassed by love, and that would be the realization of the brotherhood of man.
Okay, here's another one. Everyone knows the benign virus paragraph.
Yeah.
It's a platitude. Yeah. Okay. It's, you know, when you actually, you know, engage the physics of this paragraph, it's disturbingly vigorous, actually. And I won't go all the way on how disturbing it is here tonight, because it's kind of a the substance of more challenging things we do in the Reawakening Philosophy Seminar. Okay, but just look at how this starts out, you know, and think about it. Don't just, it's like, ooh, those are fun words to say. You cannot truly love your fellows by a mere act of the will. Okay, that is the most disturbing statement for first milers. Okay. And those first milers reading the Urantia book, for instance, who every time the revelators refer to, boil it down to consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father. They do it constantly all throughout the book. Okay? And in the old wineskin, the first milers, you know, that consecration is period, end of story. I mean, I'm basically, my actions are divine once I've consecrated my will to the perfect will of God the Father, you unconsciously are thinking. You cannot truly love your fellows by a mere act of the will. So if all I do is consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father, I'll get love, but I'll put it in a false sphere. Without the companion consecration, you don't get true love, you get false love. If all you do is consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father, you get false love. Remember how when they give you another challenging thing with the Lucifer Rebellion about the difference between true and false liberty? See, this is a companion. It's like, wait a minute, liberty? Okay, that's innately true. No. Love, that's innately true. No. It's a double-edged sword. Just like there's true and false liberty, there's true and false love. Okay? Now, the only way for it to be true love instead of false love is to add the consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You have to be able to put it in that holistic context. You're not some innately divined island universe, right? That the Father's making you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look at, you know, further on there when they say, love is infectious, and when human devotion is intelligent and wise, love is more catching than hate. Okay. When human devotion is intelligent and wise, oh, well, that happens automatically if I've consecrated my will to the perfect will of God the Father. No. 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 Unless you think you're innately divine and you've adopted the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. Okay? No, that wisdom part, which is the foundational one, intelligent and wise, okay, not wise and intelligent, okay, it starts with that philosophy stuff that we were talking about in the early part of this section, okay? Right? That you don't get wisdom by consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father. Right? You consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, and through effort, struggle, conflict, etc., you're and flying favorable conditions, you are grown into wisdom. Right? It's a huge process to convert. You know, once you've initiated love, all caps, okay, then the difficulty begins, then the problems of growth begin. You now have to see to that love as being true instead of false. Because if it's false love, then it's not a benign virus, it's a malignant virus. Right? In your ignorance, right, you actually become a seeder of a malignant virus throughout the world, which is probably going to end how? In the interregnum. Right? Now, it's part of the emergency. There's a lot of false love, just like false liberty is tearing everything apart.
Chris, what is the definition of interregnum?
Between reigns, right? I mean, you know, order breaks down. Now, the very fact that you call it an interregnum is because you have hope, right? You know that mankind is not ultimately responsible for getting the world to light and life. It's built into the evolutionary system. Right? You know that there'll be order reestablished eventually, but you're between orders. You're in an inter-reign. You're in an interregnum.
Like now?
We're entering, we're on the quivering on the very brink of, fully going into it. You know, we've entered the age of endarkenment, and, that culminates in an interregnum. It's like the book tries to lay out why the book is here, to give us the opportunity to, if there isn't some sort of an interventionary thing, of a father-like thing, and a small group of leader material doesn't predicate their leadership on the cosmic consciousness that the revelation can foster in them, okay, then it's a given. Right? I mean, the book is here because without something like that, the interregnum will happen. Right? That's the emergency. Right? It's in play. If nothing changes course, there will be a new, very deep, very, very long Dark Ages. Okay? It
starts with a quarantine.
Right? We got quarantines and viruses and, see, Plague. Kind of familiar to what we're, things we're hearing about these days.
Chris?
Yep.
I just wanted to say what... trying to love people is like for me. And if I'm not spontaneous and genuine in my attitude and openness to understanding, I just can't do it. And I just kind of let it go until I'm ready to open up like that. Mm-hmm. Like I never feel like I can force it. Otherwise, I know I'm being fake and I can't do that. I don't like doing
fake thing. Remember what they said up there in the last paragraph of the preceding section. Which is very important when you try to think about loving someone else. Okay? Love cannot be created, manufactured, or purchased. It must grow. I mean, you can use the full powers of your personality. You can't create it. You can't just squint and boom, you love someone. See, again, it has to be grown.
That would be a mere act of will.
Right.
When I try to force it, that mind that protests really kicks in.
Yeah. So
it just gets worse.
See, look at how we've got complication upon complication. Okay, step one, the love step. Okay, they told you in the preceding section that has to be grown. But then you've just begun. Once you have genuine love there that's been grown in, now you've got the whole problem that naturally, because there's inadequate wisdom, that love that's been grown in you is going to manifest falsely and actually do more harm than good. Right? To him whom much is given is much expected. You know, and if you don't rise to that, you are more damaging than you were before. An unwise human is much more damaging than any rampaging animal. Right? Okay, you know, back to this paragraph here. Notice these things that they're saying here about the physics of this. So if you have, you know, genuine love, and it's true, okay, it is infectious. That kind of love is more catching than hate. But then they say, but only genuine and unselfish love is truly contagious. So if you do what kind of, you know, you have this initial attempt to consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father, and let's say, you know, give you full benefit of the doubt, let's say you get some L-O-V-E in all caps, you know, initiated up there eventually, right? But you haven't gone beyond that, and so it's false love. Well, that's not catching. You just sort of are going to be immediately damaging, you know, to those around you in that mode, that false mode. But the natural thing, where if you like they said in the first paragraph about that patterning, that unconscious patterning, and if my natural temperament dislikes you, slowly over time, like they said there in that first paragraph, unconsciously, my personality will turn that dislike into a hate. It will pattern it. It will purpose it. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so, we've got two things on the planet. We have hate, which is very contagious, which is kind of just happens naturally because of dislikes getting exalted unconsciously into hatreds. And we have a few people that are trying to consecrate their will to the perfect will of God the Father, but haven't gone beyond that, and just have false love, and that's not contagious, and it's damaging too. That's what we got. Yeah. Okay? What we need is true love. We need duly consecrated individuals who've been grown to have a love nucleus and have grown the wisdom, the personal living philosophy, right, that surrounds that love nucleus in the upper domain, and down through that manifests something that benefits the world and is very contagious to boot.
And it didn't come from China.
So you can just, it's not coming from anywhere, see? And that's why there's an emergency. Someone needs to do this. You can't just fall into that trap that Lucifer, you know, and crew fell into, where you think you do some sort of initial step and then everything else just happens automatically. You know, you find liberty, okay, now you got problems. Because to begin with, you can't have true liberty. You can only have false liberty. So, you know, initially, see, when you're in that adolescent phase, it's like, you know, I'm wondering if it's actually would have been better if they hadn't gotten to liberty at all and stayed in the child stage. Now they're in this adolescent phase and they've got liberty, but they don't have true liberty. All they've got is false liberty. And man, oh man, is it problematic. But you got to keep going. You got to be grown further through the adolescence into adulthood where there's true liberty. And love is the same way.
The dicey period in Jesus' transitional years.
Right? Yeah, like I pointed out, the whole universe was kind of sitting on the edge of its seats, like, ooh, what's going to happen when he goes through adolescence here? Right? This could all go very poorly. But Gabriel selected his family and location well, and he made it through. You know, and the other thing to remember when they talk about, you know, pervading the sentimental emotion stream and whatnot, oh no, they're saying that love is a feeling. It's like, no, they're not. Okay? You know they're not. They capitalize L-O-V-E in this section just to remind you to not go into that mode. Because when you get to this paragraph, if you're thinking love is a feeling, okay, you're just going to mess this up. Right? I mean, like we were just saying, I mean, compassion comes down to a feeling of sympathy. Right? Love comes down to feelings too. Right? I mean, there are always feelings. And but to have something beyond above feelings, you know, as a predicate for these feelings, instead of just being a helpless victim of antecedent causation, having the environment just produce feelings and then you spew them back out again. Right. So, like I said, this is, you know, this is very challenging stuff. I mean, you know. Everyone, I mean, the lazy animal in us doesn't want it to be this complicated and take this long. We're impatient. You know, the more initially spiritualized we are, the more impatient we are. You know, ask Adam and Eve. Just to find the patience to let all of this grow before you start thrusting yourself out aggressively, like everyone is tending to do and causing an emergency on the planet. We all need to take a humble, deep breath here a little bit, you know, and let us be grown through this adolescent phase, you know, lest we just completely destroy civilization in our adolescence.
It sounds so much more stable when you're talking about thinking the truth, you know, and being more wise and more balanced, yeah, and using that as your perspective to do your life. It just seems, if you're just in the moment and animalistic and just responding with, you know, not reflecting and just responding on a, you know, reacting,
mm-hmm,
it right. just sounds like it sounds like a nightmare. It sounds so hard.
Yeah.
Complicated and unstable, and
yeah,
that sounds scary.
Yeah, it's so quote unquote scary, unstable, whatnot, nightmarish. That right, there's an actual emergency. Beings in the super universe level, right, responded to this situation. You know, not just a local universe. I mean, it's a serious situation, right?
Yeah, and my daughter just pulled out of the driveway with our car.
See, and it's just, and to recognize that the emergency is caused by adolescent spiritual minds. We're not just mere children of God. We've been evolved into adolescence, and we have no idea of the demands there. You know, we're not challenging ourselves with the recognition of appropriate personal responsibility and the mastery of self-control, right? The exercising of self-control to go with that recognition of responsibility. So we have false liberty, false love, all these spiritual things. We are, you know, they're making things worse, not better. And that's very difficult, right? It's so not what humans have always believed about liberty and love. See, and it's because we unwittingly adopt the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. We think we're innately divine. Like the first paragraph said here, you unwittingly pattern things. Mm-hmm. See, and when you pattern something that shouldn't be patterned, what that means is you're treating it as it's divine, as if it's divine.
To the point of the super universe taking notice.
Oh.
In our case.
I mean, it's almost impossible to not have adopted the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto unwittingly. That's what you do naturally. You're gonna have to, you know, get some consciousness in play to go to, you know, to the second principle and then the first principle. But the third principle, you know, that soul selfism, that solipsism, I mean, that just happens naturally. I mean, that's what the first paragraph of the section tells you. Okay.
It seems like it's so important to understand what the Lucifer Rebellion was and be able to recognize the pattern, because we run into it every day.
Yeah. You got to know the physics of it.
In people's perspectives and being able to have that understanding is essential.
It is, yeah. So I bring it up all the time. I mean, you know, now if you're a timid soul, okay, this is all very scary and you're probably humming right now. This is for courageous and independent thinkers. It's not for those timid souls, right? Like I said, I mean, it all seems warm and fuzzy until you start to really analyze what's in these paragraphs here. It's like, wow, okay, that's scary for me, the animal, right? When someone tells me that naturally I have false love and that's catastrophic, okay, I was so innocent. I thought if I just love, okay, everything, no. Yeah, it'd be better if you weren't predicated on it, you know. You gotta that courageous part of courageous and independent cosmic thinking is so important. You have to have the courage to face this, because it's for the animal in you. It's very scary what this book is saying. Yeah, there's an emergency, and you're the source of it. I mean, that's scary stuff.
And there's hope too.
But there's hope. Yeah. Right? Not wishful thinking, right? But genuine hope, right? The essence of trust. Right? Where you see that which is not naturally seeable, and you base your relationship, your sense of the future on that, the potentiality, right? that you know is there. All right. We probably won't get through this whole section, but we can get in a little ways here, I think, probably. It might seem like a jarring discontinuity to go from all this stuff about growth and love and whatnot to conversion and mysticism. But, you know, the way I just fleshed out, like especially that last paragraph, you should see it's not as... All of this delusional stuff that humans have always done, where they're thinking they're spiritual, or maybe they're unwittingly kind of getting into it a little bit, but there's no, you know, philosophic proper framing. Yeah, you see, it's actually the same topic. Let me get into quote-unquote conversion, and mysticism.
Were you going to... touch on the focus of dynamic affection? It seemed like that was still...
Oh.
As an extension of what you'd already done.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely... I mean, the focus of...
False love isn't like that.
Right, I mean, you know, just, you know, you can think about many things there. I mean, like we said, you have to get control of the fear because you've got to use the focus essence of it. Right? Yeah. In order to have a focus of anything, let alone of divine affection, or dynamic affection. You know, it's not mere affection. It's got this incredible self-animating spirit nature that makes it dynamic behind it. Yeah. Right? And the unstated part of that is it's a focus of dynamic true affection. Mm-hmm. Right, this benign virus. Right, but if it's a focus of dynamic false affection, right, then it's the malignant virus. And the only way that you can recognize that you've got that duality, sort of, you know, in that statement, is by going back to the first sentence. It's like you cannot truly love. Right, the truly part isn't just a fancifying word. It's a physics word, and you got to think about it. And that means there's also falsely love.
Yeah. Which is still contagious.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, like you said, I mean, you know, if you get it really, see, if it's definitively false, it's not, you know, there isn't spiritual gravity, and it's not so contagious.
Maybe not so virulent.
Right, yeah, you sort of, you sort of...
continue.
You mask you shield, let's say it that way, you shield the spirit gravity of the love by wrapping it in falsehood. That spiritual gravity can't get out except through truth. Can't get out through falsehood. But hatred, that's a spiritual thing. It's got gravity. It's just very contagious. I mean, people are easily drawn to hatred.
Kind of the seductive.
Yeah, it's very seductive, right? Like I said, especially if you think you're justified in, and that objectionable conduct, it's worthy of intolerance and hatred. And I mean, everyone just joins in. Oh man, it's so fun to hate this person. It just sweeps like wildfire. Yeah. You got millions of people collectively hating someone in short order once someone starts the flame. All right, so let's see how far we can get into it a little bit here on conversion and mysticism.
Section 5, Conversion and Mysticism. The world is filled with lost souls, not lost in the theologic sense, but lost in the directional meaning, wandering about in confusion among the isms and cults of a frustrated philosophic era. Too few have learned how to install a philosophy of living in the place of religious authority. The symbols of socialized religion are not to be despised as channels of growth, albeit the riverbed is not the river.
Let me just deal with that parenthetical first. Let's go to Jesus as a ready example. Jesus was born into a particular riverbed. They make a strong point in part 4 of explaining how important it was that he was born into that definitive evolutionary religion Jewish riverbed. It's through that channel that he can eventually mature to what he matured into. Without that riverbed, he never would have gotten there. It doesn't matter how rote and ritualistic and whatnot, every service was at the synagogue that he attended as a child. The symbols of socialized religion are not to be despised as channels of growth. Right? He's a living demonstration of why they're not to be despised. That channel that he was born into carried him all the way to first circular, eventually, and the doorstep of fusion. So, that's a simple way to appreciate that parenthetical. They're pointing out too few have learned how to install a philosophy of living in the place of religious authority. Notice the farther we get into these five papers about religion, the more we have to talk about philosophy, because we need true religion. You need that philosophic encompassment. There's this philosophic emergency, this frustrated philosophic era. And as we talk about all the time, especially in the wake of the sixth adjutant dawning in the collective in the middle of the 20th century, wandering about in confusion among the isms and cults of this frustrated philosophic era we're in.
Yeah, quite the script.
Right. So ism, ism, ism everywhere you turn. Right?
And this was back in the 30s.
But of course, they're writing it. They're writing it for hundreds of years forward, from the beginning of the 20th century.
That seems like nothing compared.
I mean, before the middle of the 20th century, like I was just saying, the isms seem nothing. But you. Remember, when you had the fifth adjutant dawn in the collective in the middle of the 19th century, you've got enough, that adjutant, is not directly a unity adjutant, but it's immediately benefits from its juxtaposition to the unity adjunct of the sixth. You know, remember how there's a difference between is value and has value, right? Mm-hmm. See, so that fifth one, you know, you don't say it is value, but you can say it has value. And so there's enough energy that you started to get some pretty aggressive isms like socialism and communism. You know, not to mention, you know, springing up in there positivism, you know, and et cetera. Okay. But once you fire up, you know, this greater energization with the sixth, you know, in the leading collective of mankind, okay, then you really start to get isms. Yeah. And, think about, some of them have burned out already, but think about how many cults you spawned, you know, you know, all kinds of newfangled cults, you know, some cult leader, you know, was spawned. Okay, so this whole bit of not lost in the theologic sense, I mean, and one of the things underlying that we said early on, okay, the fourth epical revelation dealt with, being lost in the theologic sense, okay? It's not a spiritual emergency. You as an individual, you know, no matter how adolescently confused you are and how problematic the world is, you're going to wake up in the first mansion world, you know, and forward you go from there, okay? But we've got, no one has the big picture, so we're lost in the directional meaning, you know, as they're saying there. Right? The philosophic framework is not there. So everyone is becoming more and more lost in the directional meaning. Right, so that's the key issue. It's a philosophic emergency, not a spiritual one.
The progression of religious growth leads from stagnation through conflict to coordination, from insecurity to undoubting faith, from confusion of cosmic consciousness to unification of personality, from the temporal objective to the eternal, from the bondage of fear to the liberty of divine sonship.
Now, so that paragraph, kind of just saying in so many ways there that what you achieve through that path to progress. And notice they used as an opportunity to add one additional term in there. You know, they brought up through conflict. You know, there's our conflict again. So you're thinking, oh yeah, effort, struggle, conflict. Those are eight steps, right? I mean, you don't start with effort. That first step is effort. It's like, well, where did you start from? What's the zero level, if you will, right? Stagnation, right? Starts, you know, on one end is stagnation, right? And you culminate in progress. So you're sitting there in stagnation and you make that first step of effort.
Why did you make the stage step of effort, though? And you'd have to see some kind of value in that.
Yeah, remember, and that's why they were talking about, you know, you've got some initial flashes of recognition, you know, that come into play. It's like, you know, I need to make an effort here. But you don't recognize to begin with, it goes effort, and then it goes to struggle, and then it gets to conflict, you know. So, you know, it doesn't play out like that. Initial recognition made it appear as like, oh, you know, just a little bit of effort and then it's going to be sunshine and lollipops, you know, motivated by this recognition I've got. It's like, no, it's a very difficult process. The difficulty has just begun when you manage to get a little bit of an insight and then some initial recognition to motivate you out of that stagnation.
Could you have a crisis of stagnation?
Very often, you know, there's someone hits you on the side of the head with a sledgehammer, you know, and you pause for a second. It's like, wait a minute, I see there's an issue here, right? And, you know, that it gets you to reflect for a second, right? And you get this little bit of insight, right? And it motivates you, right, to get out of that stagnant state.
Okay.
the getting hit upside the head or finding yourself in a foxhole is one thing, mm-hmm. but that only takes you for a little ways. If you see the value at the end of that path, mm-hmm. if you can see that, hey, you know, there is value in, you know, getting to that point, then you'll keep working through all of the steps and yeah. it'll keep pulling on you.
Yeah.
But even if you, at the beginning, get whopped upside the head, you're still not going to keep going unless
yeah.
you recognize the value
you can
in
start
the
to
path.
See, yeah, you can start to see the end from the beginning a bit, yeah. And that reflective, you know, beginning state, in its more complete sense, not only motivates a beginning, but you know adds a view of the end point, right? and keeps you going through, like you're saying. Yeah.
Otherwise, why would you make it?
Right. Because yeah. when it gets the conflict, you're gonna
why would you
peter out.
Why would you yeah. keep going?
Yeah.
How do you help others do that, though, to get to that point?
Sledgehammers.
Right. Yeah. Remember if, the angels are there to build speed bumps, right, you know, for this very reason. But eventually you can learn by looking, right, as well as by leaping. So, I mean, to begin with, the only thing that gets us started is a sledgehammer, right, and the angels wield the sledgehammers. But eventually you mature a little bit and you don't have to be hit upside the head. You're reflecting more just all the time, and you start to, you know, recognize things by looking. And so as you mature, it transitions from sledgehammers to insight. And self-initiated insight.
And how do you help others?
Obviously you can model this and eventually they can, you know, pick up on it, but you have to recognize that there really isn't any way for them to avoid the sledgehammer part of it, right? It's just like in the big picture, the first four indispensables, right, are sledgehammers, slavery, war, social classes, profit motive, right? We all have to start that way. You know, and if you're fortunate, you don't die during that part of it. But if you do, you pick up on the first management world, right? But it's a very difficult thing to get started because it's just there's no way an animal, you know, origin creature like us can just see things to begin with. You know, we have to be hit by something. That's just.
It's
just the way it works. Yeah.
Maxwell.
I mean, everyone knows, you know, that, you know, for, you know, if you touch the stove one time, you don't touch it again. You know, problem solved. You know, and when you're 50, you go, oh yeah, there's that scar from when I touched the stove, right? And it reminds you.
Pretty darn efficient.
Yeah. All right, so that's they're kind of just reminding you again. See, if you've got this whole process you're going to go through, and you can think about it, you know, as going from bondage of fear to liberty of divine sonship, or what have you. But that path from stagnation, you know, to this coordinated progressing phenomenon. Yeah. All right.
It should be made clear that professions of loyalty to the supreme ideals, the psychic, emotional, and spiritual awareness of God consciousness, may be a natural and gradual growth, or may sometimes be experienced at certain junctures, such as a crisis. As in a crisis. The Apostle Paul experienced just such a sudden and spectacular conversion that eventful day on the Damascus Road. Gautama Siddhartha had a similar experience the night he sat alone and sought to penetrate the mystery of final truth. Many others have had like experiences, and many true believers have progressed in the spirit without sudden conversion.
Can you name a true believer who progressed in the Spirit without sudden conversion?
Jesus.
Yes. I often remind people about this paragraph, but you know, we just read it, so I got to remind you again. So indulge me if you've heard this a million times, but you know, this is another very important paragraph that's very difficult to get yourself out of the mode that you've been trained in. You've been trained, especially if you have any Christian upbringing, but like they mentioned, it's not just amongst the Christians, amongst the Buddhists too. It's very difficult to think in a way that isn't biased to Paul. Okay? That what you're looking for is a Pauline conversion event in your life. You know, and subsequently you're born of the Spirit. Right? All these things are rationalized relative to Paul in general. And Jesus is just chopped liver. Okay? No one reminds themselves that, you know, Jesus didn't, he is nothing but gradualism. There is no step function, right? You know, no saltation, you know, where he jumps up, right? And then tries to maintain a higher state after that. That's literally part of the construct of the last paper in the book. Right? The paper that's entitled The Faith of Jesus. Mm-hmm. In contrast to the faith of Paul, okay, which is all predicated on a quote-unquote conversion event, right? The faith of Jesus has no such predicate. Faith of Jesus is results from a long gradualism. And that fact is the reason why very, very mysteriously, strangely, bizarrely, the preface of the last paper in the book doesn't seem like a preface at all. It's this preface that goes on and on and on. It's like, shouldn't this be like the first section? Why is this the preface? It's because, okay, it's about the faith of Jesus. The paper is about the faith of Jesus. The preface to the faith of Jesus is a long gradual. They literally encoded that in the way they constructed the paper. Right? You don't get to section one, Jesus the man who has that faith, by some short little description of his conversion event and then section one. Right? You get that long gradual. Right? That gets you the faith of Jesus. And they bring this up because it's an exception that's one of these suddenlies produces a stable consequence. It often produces pretty squirrely stuff afterwards. And then when people sort of try to model themselves after, you know, these exceptions, you know, like Paul or Gautama, they try to build these things. They try to make them happen. Okay, and then there's, in general, no reality to them. They're just inducing some bizarre psychologic state, you know, that actually is taking you further from God than getting you closer to God. Further from genuine faith than closer to genuine faith. Right? So, between the lines of this paragraph is the contrast between, okay, on the one hand, you have the faith of Paul, okay, and you can develop a whole evolutionary religion basically based upon the faith of Paul called Christianity. Or you could develop a religion based upon the faith of Jesus. What would that be like? That wasn't so caught up in conversion and mysticism and what have you. Okay, the other thing there is that opening statement, you know, look at how they kind of challenge you to think about supreme ideals, the psychic, emotional, and spiritual awareness of God consciousness. Again, like I said, think of that God consciousness as something so high you can't even imagine what they're talking about. Okay, that might actually get up to the supremacy ceiling, right, of supreme ideals. Yeah, don't think, oh, I know, yeah, I'm God conscious, so I'm all over the supreme ideals. So you could really muddle that that statement if you underplay what God consciousness means. Let's see, anything else there? You know, the very fact that it's a sudden and spectacular conversion. Like I said, I mean, let's assume there's a genuineness to this conversion event. But it is sudden and spectacular. The emotional consequences, the amount of heat that light generates, this is not light without heat. Right? These conversion things are light with tons of heat. Tons of emotional consequences, and so disruptive that, like I said, I mean, it's an exceptional individual that doesn't just go all squirrely after this because of the emotional consequences of this event. You get a little flash of your adjuster, good luck. Yeah. It's probably going to mess your mentality up for the rest of your life. You're not ready to get a definitive flash of your adjuster as a seventh circler, and something like that. The emotional consequences are so severe that it's just going to mess you up probably for the rest of your life. Very unlikely that you're going to handle that well. Okay. Now, conversion events are not, you know, genuine conversion events aren't necessarily getting a flash of your adjuster, but see, they're like that.
Is that in line with the danger of self-acting adjuster?
Yeah, and see, a self-acting adjuster is something that's, there's movement change there. You're likely to notice it. Okay, and then, you know, you're off to the squirrely races, okay? similar to having that self-acting adjuster, this, you know, more dynamic, might actually be unplugging and replugging and something. I mean, you know, if you start out, if your initial temperament is such that when the adjuster plugs in at roughly age 6, you have an awareness of that. That's really, really problematic. All the king's horses and all the king's men. I mean, it may not mess you up initially. You may go for 20 years and it seems like it's okay, but eventually this is going to come around. Because that flash, you're gonna be certain deep down that you're God. You're not thinking, oh, that was my adjuster arriving. That's not me. I'm very humble and lowly. No, it's like, whoa, I'm God. It's going to really mess you up. It's going to give you delusions of grandeur as you go forward. It's going to cause all kinds of problems. You're going to try to somehow get back that kind of flash. So you'll probably try the most intense drugs you can find or something. Try to, make that kind of a flash happen, you know, vivid flash happen again. And eventually that's going to totally mess you up. And I mean, it's just going to be very problematic.
Most likely.
Most likely.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Right.
they are alarmed about it.
Yeah. They mentioned Paul and Gautama. They said, oh, you know, there's thousands and thousands of them that handled it, you know, relatively stably. No. Okay.
Okay, there's these couple again.
I mean, the ones that don't handle it well stand out more than the ones that do.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. But see, in general, you're not supposed to know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you go, oh, it's wonderful. I knew. It's like, no, that's not a blessing. That's a curse. You're not supposed to know when it plugs in. You're too immature to get a flash like that. Right? Seven circlers are not first circlers. A first circler is a mind that's been grown to be able to handle that. Seven circular can't handle it. So, you know, you just, it's supposed to enter unawares.
Which kind of lends to the efficacy of the gradual.
Yeah, again.
In Jesus' case, wasn't going to be any steppy going on there.
Yeah, you're not, Jesus didn't get this unmanageable flash, you know, or anything. Completely oblivious. That's the way it's supposed to be. You know, and it should be that way until you're well into first circular. Yeah, and so, you know, we won't get to it here tonight, but as they remind you later on in this section, don't go in search of these sorts of vivid things.
Under no circumstances?
Very problematic.
Once you're plugged in, can you be unplugged by the acts that you do?
I mean, the only way, I mean, once the adjuster engages you, the only way it will permanently leave is if you are spiritually dead, right? If you go to iniquity. Otherwise, it's there. Yeah, it's imprisoned in your mind, remember. And the only exception is self-acting adjuster. But when you got a planet that can't handle a lot of them, you know, they're not going to be sending them, right? I mean, they don't delight in, you know, turning people into crazies, right? Let's send a whole bunch of self-acting adjusters and watch everyone blow up. I mean, that's...
I'll make the pop.
Does that sound compassionate? You know, the problem is there needs to be some self-acting adjusters, you know, due to, you know, technical reasons that are beyond our comprehension, you know, for the spiritual economy and things. You know, and so it's a problem for the planetary government if you don't have some people that can stably have self-acting adjusters. Yeah. All right, let's get a little bit more here.
Most of the spectacular phenomenon associated with so-called religious conversions are entirely psychological in nature. But now and then there do occur experiences which are also spiritual in origin. When the mental mobilization is absolutely total, on any level of the psychic upreach toward spirit attainment, when there exists perfection of the human motivation of loyalties to the divine idea, then there very often occurs a sudden downgrasp of the indwelling spirit to synchronize with the concentrated and consecrated purpose of the superconscious mind of the believing mortal. And it is such experiences of unified intellectual and spiritual phenomena that constitute the conversion, which consists in factors over and above purely psychologic involvement.
Okay, notice how definitive they were, lest you delusionally think, oh yeah, I had that experience. I had a genuine conversion experience. Like, well, okay, some humility here. It said absolutely total. Pretty strong statement.
Yeah.
Okay. Not the way we use absolutely all the time, the way the book uses the word absolutely. It has to be absolutely total and perfection of the human motivation. Perfection of the human motivation. Okay, so the refinement of mind, the stability of mind that in order to achieve absolutely total and perfection of human motivation. Okay, in other words, they're telling you, okay, in general, everyone's conversion events are these vivid heat things that people generate in some way, and then assume are something greater, especially if you've discovered the Urantia book. You know, you're going to assume, I just contacted my thought adjuster. It's like, no, remember we've talked about this. It's so important to understand that you can generate a vivid island of heat that's so definitive, there's no way you won't conclude that you just contacted your adjuster. You can make a fake adjuster. Yeah, experience very definitively, and that should be a sobering statement.
You're about to talk
Yeah, which they, yeah, they, you know, we won't get to the fullness of it, but we're going to read it. It's one more little paragraph. But see, just notice, you know, if you aren't just reading these things with your fuzzy unity consciousness, if you can bring your mind to focus a bit and notice words like absolutely and perfection, it's like, oh, okay, wait a minute. It's my favorite experience in my life, but I probably should be humble about it.
Yeah.
You know, and remember, there's a spot in the book they tell you, you should assume that that was something you ate. Okay. Not your adjuster. But what if it was? No, even if it was, assume it was something you ate. All right? Because it's so problematic. All right, one little bit here.
But emotion alone is a false conversion. One must have faith as well as feeling. To the extent that such psychic mobilization is partial, and insofar as such human loyalty motivation is incomplete, to that extent will the experience of conversion be a blended intellectual, emotional, and spiritual reality.
And your first thought is, see, Chris? I mean, okay, so I didn't have that absolutely total and perfection. Mine was partial, I'll admit it. My human loyalty motivation was incomplete, but there was some spiritual reality to it. Yeah, but not just. What about all the emotional stuff, all that heat? Right? What that little bit of spiritual is just going to get a wash in that froth of emotion, okay? And, you know, when all is said and done, is it going to be a net positive? Probably not. Right? It's best to not go in search of this because you're going to fall short. Right? And it's going to be this half-hearted thing that is fraught with emotional froth that is just, at the very least, is going to make you unbearable for others to live with. Right? You know, and at worst, is going to lead to all sorts of delusions of self-righteousness and stuff. Okay.
I'm just going to block you.
So why don't you stop trying to be like Paul, and why don't you try to be like Jesus? And they'll bring that up more as we go forward next time.
You won't feel slighted at
all. Right. I mean, are you really getting the short straw if you do the Jesus thing instead of the Paul thing? who went further, Jesus or Paul?
Damascus Road or
patience. Right? The tortoise wins in the end. Yeah. Not the Pauline hare. The Jesusonian tortoise wins in the end.
Serviceable fairy tales.
All right. So we'll pick it up there next time. Remember, fear not, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Don't be afraid to take on the rigors of what these statements are really, what these passages are really saying. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.